Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, December 15th, 2024. This program was previously broadcast on August 25th, 2024. We open with an article from CSA News, Growing Small Grains in Subarctic Alaska. Breeding barley, studying soil, and focusing on farmers in the last frontier, by Tess Jossi. The largest state in the U.S., Alaska, has only 1% of its land devoted to agriculture. There's a strong need for and interest in increasing local production to help fortify food security in the state. The Alaska Collaborative Food Production Systems Project develops research projects and supports agricultural producers in the state. At the 2023 annual meeting for crop science and soil science organizations, researchers from the team talked about the project's objectives and progress. With one growing season under their belts, they've made headway on breeding trials, gathered novel data on soil health and quality, finished a year of cover crop trials, and interviewed producers and consumers about food agency in the state of Alaska. It's a well-worn observation, but the sheer size of Alaska is staggering. The largest state in the Union, its area is larger than the next three biggest states in the U.S., Texas, California, and Montana combined. Less than 1% of that area is devoted to agriculture, but that doesn't mean Alaska is not fertile ground for farming. By the USDA's count, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the state has the highest rate of new and beginning farmers in the U.S. Farmers successfully grow barley, potatoes, specialty crops, and flowers. And there's a strong need for and interest in increasing local production to help fortify food security in the state, which relies heavily on imports. The demand for locally produced food and sustainable farm practices is very high because of our geographic isolation, and the agricultural science that happens elsewhere doesn't necessarily translate well to our unique environment and growing conditions, says Kaylee Gosh, a soil scientist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, UAF. The Alaska Collaborative Food Production Systems Project, a collaboration between UAF and the USDA ARS Northern Great Plains Research Laboratory in Mandan, North Dakota, and the Edward T. Schaefer Agricultural Research Center in Fargo, North Dakota, aims to fill that gap. As Alaska does not have full-time ARS staff, the cooperative agreement between the institutions develops research projects and supports agricultural producers in the state. The collaboration also includes producers and community stakeholders. Researchers from the team presented the project's objectives and progress at the 2023 annual meeting. With one growing season under their belts, they've made headway on breeding trials, gathered novel data on soil health and quality, finished a year of cover crop trials, and interviewed producers and consumers about food agency in the state. Here, we talk with Gash, USDA ARS social scientist Claire Friedrichsen, and UAF plant geneticist Jaquir Hassan about the project and its goals. A short history of Delta barley. In the late 1970s, Alaska had large budget surpluses to spend due to booming revenue from oil development, and then-Governor Jay Hammond decided that the state needed to broaden its economic base through agriculture. The government focused on Delta Junction, an area in a river valley about 100 miles south of Fairbanks in Alaska's interior, first. They auctioned off more than 80,000 acres of state-owned land for farmers to grow barley, which has a short growing season and can mature at cooler temperatures. The goal was to increase food security for the state and produce more agricultural output, Gash says. In 1982, the state agency managing the program predicted 500,000 acres would be in cultivation by 1992. But as the political winds shifted, support for the project waned. Promised infrastructure was never built, funding was cut, and other initiatives stalled. By 1998, only 7 of the original 37 landowners from the original Delta sales retained ownership of the land. Many of the farmers had foreclosed and gone into significant debt. There were a lot of farmers that burned out, says ASA member Claire Friedrichsen. However, barley lives on in the region, with its farmers currently producing spring barley as well as spring oats and spring wheat. According to the most recent USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service Census of Agriculture, there were 22 farms producing just under 5,000 total acres of barley for grain in all of Alaska in 2022. Most of that grain goes into animal feed, though one Delta-based operation, the Alaska Flour Company, sells barley cereal, brownie mix, and pancake batter via the only commercial flour mill in the state. Other producers throughout Alaska grow a multitude of vegetables and specialty crops for direct distribution through farmers markets or community-supported agriculture programs. And in July, August, and September, dozens of Alaskan flower farmers export thousands of peony stems around the globe. The cooler climate allows the lucrative flowers to bloom during these months when they don't in any other part of the world. A warming climate. While it's a boon for peony exports, unsurprisingly, the Alaskan climate presents a challenge to agriculture at large. Long, cold winters stretch from October to April, and the growing season typically ranges from 90 to 120 days. Summer's long days, clocking as much as 23 hours of sunlight each, help offset the short season. Alaska is heating up faster than other parts of the globe, and the interior is warming faster than other parts of the state, which makes the climate more suitable for these types of small grain production, says CSSA member Jakir Hassan. Climate models from UAF's Scenarios Network for Alaska Plus Minus Arctic Planning predict that the growing season in Delta Junction could stretch to 155 days by the end of the 21st century. Climate change presents an existential threat to Alaskan ecosystems and to the many people who hunt, gather, and catch wild foods throughout the state. For row crops, the warming temperatures and shifting conditions could allow producers to grow species that haven't fared well in the past. We are interested in reviving some of those questions. On what species can we grow in this new and changing climate? Gash says. Breeding new barley lines. With their effort to study and breed small grain crops in the state, however, the Collaborative Food Production Systems Project first focused on barley. Over the last few years, Hassan established a brand new breeding program at UAF. We started from nothing, he says. He built a gene pool for more than 800 germplasm of two-row and six-row barley obtained from the USDA ARS Germ Plasma Resources Information Network and the Nordic Genetic Resource Center in Sweden. He also obtained several hundred accessions of wheat and oil and tested them to see what genotypes grow well in Alaska's climate. From those groups of germplasm, we identified a portion that can be introduced to the farmer immediately as a potential variety to grow on their farm and meet their demand, Hassan says. At the same time, the researchers are also developing their own hybrid lines by making crosses with the old Alaskan and Nordic varieties. They made these first crosses last winter and are currently harvesting the F4 generation in the greenhouse, using speed breeding to accelerate the population development. The researchers will look for traits like early heading, early maturity, and the ability to produce higher grain, even in the exceptionally long photoperiod conditions experienced in the Alaskan growing season. Early maturity is typically linked with poor yield, and therefore this is one of the trade-offs. We are looking for the variety that goes into reproductive stage sooner, and at the same time there is no penalty on grain yield, Hassan says. This summer, they will plant the climate-suited selection of germplasm identified in last year's trial in the field to determine which have the highest yield potential. Last year, Hassan also planted new test crops that might adapt to the interior Alaskan climate, including kernza and perennial wheat. One of our primary objectives is to see whether they have the winter hardiness, whether they will survive through Alaska's winter or not, he explains. Soil health and cover cropping. Hassan's barley trials also incorporate Gash's soil health research. The two are collaborating to investigate the different below-ground plant traits of the test barley lines. I'm excited about the opportunity that a breeding program is considering soil and below-ground traits, Gash says. Her broader piece of the puzzle is investigating how management practices impact soil health in the state's different cropping systems. I'm working with both small grain farmers and specialty crop farmers to identify management practices that enhance and protect soil. Soils in Alaska are young and nutrient poor. It's fresh glacial till, essentially, Gash says. The farms in the state's interior were carved out of boreal forest and contain shallow and acidic soils. The boreal forest presents a challenge, too, for expanding agriculture into new areas. That land has to be cleared, and transportation networks through the state are limited. Sections of the state's soils have never been fully surveyed and assessed for agricultural potential, Gash says. And some farmed soils have permafrost underneath. That creates a whole other set of challenges, Gash says. If an area that has permafrost is cleared, then the land warms up and there's less insulation by the vegetation. The permafrost can thaw and change the topography of the field. It's not as big of a problem on the small grain farms because those have been cleared and farmed since the 80s, she says. But certainly as agriculture continues to expand in the state, that is a challenge for new land as it's cleared and potentially experiences that permafrost thaw. For the farmers Gash works with, nutrient availability is a main concern. Synthetic fertilizer is expensive, and it's subject to supply chain disruption because of our location, she says. In her research program, she is currently testing cover crops in small grain and potato systems. Can we find local sources of fertility to meet the crop demands at scale? In the project's first growing season, Gash's goal was to see what cover crops could successfully grow. She put together a group of species potentially cold hardy enough for the climate, including several varieties of alfalfa, clovers, buckwheat, radishes, rapeseed, cereal rye, camelina, flax, and legumes, of particular interest for their ability to contribute nitrogen to the system. They found a good amount of growth for many of the tested species, and we had a couple of surprises, she says. The camelina and flax were able to produce mature seeds, so they'll explore those as a potential cash crop going forward. This year, the researchers will trial mixes of cover crops designed for specific crop rotations at two locations, with potatoes in Palmer in south central Alaska and with barley up in the interior in Fairbanks, and assess their nutrient contributions and biomass production. Food agency and craft breweries. This summer, Gash also plans to work with Friedrichsen to assess how implementing cover crops contributes to farmers' day-to-day stress and well-being. We are trying to figure out a way to measure that and also compare and contrast that with other intangible, non-economic outcomes of soil health practices, Friedrichsen says. As an expert in the human dimensions of soil management, she works to understand how humans make decisions, interact with, and value soil. For the Collaborative Food Production Systems Project, she is developing a new tool to measure the concept of food agency, a construct additional to food security, among several populations connected to agriculture in the state. Food security is a static construct that measures if people have food right now on their table or within the last month, she explains, while food agency is the ability of participants in the food system to make and meet goals around food. To create the tool, Friedrichsen conducts qualitative case studies, interviewing members of a specific population in a specific context about their food production goals and barriers to reaching them. She first focused on the small grain industry in Alaska, holding unstructured interviews with small grain farmers, as well as tractor companies, fertilizer companies, and the buyers of the barley, livestock producers, bakers, and even brewers. Alaska is home to many craft breweries and distilleries and a robust tourism industry. During this winter's case study, Friedrichsen and the team learned that the breweries wanted locally grown malting barley to use in their operations. Currently, they are relying solely on import to meet their demand, Hassan explains. but they're also interested in having access to Alaskan-grown malting barley. He's now collaborating with the University of Minnesota to test winter malting barley in Alaska to meet that need. Overall, Friedrichsen describes the uniting objective of the Collaborative Food Production Systems Project as such. How can we strengthen Alaskan identity around agriculture? And how can we foster that? Growing grains in Alaska for Alaska-made products is one avenue. Through this agreement, we're able to address those needs, Gash says, of the project. There's a lot to be done, she adds, but I think the impact is going to be very big for Alaska. And this article, Growing Small Grains in Subarctic Alaska, appears in the latest issue of CSA News. CSA News is the official monthly magazine for members of the American Society of Agronomy, ASA, Crop Science Society of America, CSSA, and Soil Science Society of America, SSSA. And now we turn to the February 2024 issue of Scientific American. Under question and answer with Ed Curry. How hot is Pepper X? The creator reveals his experience tasting the hottest pepper in the world, by Stephanie Pappas. A new world record holder has entered the field of hot peppers, Pepper X. This proprietary pepper, bred by Ed Curry, was recognized in October 2023 by Guinness World Records as the hottest pepper ever independently tested. Curry is one of the few people to have tried Pepper X raw. By all reports, the taste test involves a burning sensation followed by several hours of intestinal cramping. With a spiciness level of 2.693 million Scoville heat units, or SHU, on average, Pepper X handily unseated the previous hottest pepper on Earth, the Carolina Reaper, also bred by Curry, who founded the Puckerbutt Pepper Company, a hot pepper farm and pepper product supplier in Fort Mill, South Carolina. For comparison, jalapenos reach 2,000 to 8,000 SHU. Scientific American caught up with Curry to talk about his heat-seeking trajectory and whether hot peppers can get even spicier. An edited transcript of the interview follows. Question: what is it like in the world of hot pepper breeding? Is it a competitive field? In the pepper breeding world, there are really only a few of us who intentionally breed peppers, and they get what's called an odd phenotype and think they've got a new pepper. It's not that competitive. If it were, the Carolina Reaper wouldn't have held a record for 10 years. That's more just stuff on the internet. Most of the people who actually breed peppers aren't on social media. We talk via the phone. Question: what does the day-to-day life of a pepper breeder look like? Half the year, we're processing peppers by drying them or turning them into pepper paste. The other half of the year, we're breeding peppers. We cross-pollinate plants that have the attributes we want. If the resulting fruit has what we're looking for, we take the seeds out and plant them. If that comes out the same, that's the first generation. It takes anywhere between 8 and 12 generations to stabilize a plant, so you can start doing the testing. At Puckerbutt, we don't just breed peppers. We're one of the largest hot pepper farms in the U.S. We make hot sauce and pepper mash and dried pepper and pepper powder for all sorts of different manufacturers. Right now, I'm making test batches of hot sauce, doing interviews, and drying peppers at the same time. Question: when you're breeding peppers, what other attributes might you look for besides heat? 99% of what we do is for flavor and looks. I like getting peppers to look really weird or breeding out different colors. Question: what's your favorite weird pepper that you've bred? We have a particular variety of chocolate scotch bonnet that we call a UFO bonnet because it kind of looks like UFOs in pictures. It is a delicious pepper. It's not very high on the Scoville scale, but it is my absolute favorite pepper to eat. Don't get me wrong. I eat the super hot ones on a daily basis, but my favorites aren't super hot. They're in the mid-range of the pepper world. Editor's note, the Scoville scale measures the number of times an extraction of a pepper's capsaicinoids needs to be diluted with a mix of sugar and water before a professional panel of tasters can no longer detect those hot compounds. In laboratory tests, a machine called a high-performance liquid chromatograph can quantify capsaicinoids and other compounds in dried samples of peppers. Question: what makes pepper X so hot? The compound that makes peppers hot is called capsaicin. There are many different capsaicinoids, and these compounds react with a nerve receptor that only mammals have that sends a signal to our brain saying, "This is hot." There are a lot of other compounds that can enhance the heat or tame the heat. You can increase the tannin levels in a pepper that is not so hot, such as a Scotch bonnet, and it gives you the perception of more heat. For pepper X, I took a pepper that had a different set of capsaicinoids and bred it with the Reaper, and it turned out really hot. 9 out of 10 crossbreeds that we do go nowhere, and we have no expectation when we start. It's just playing around and having fun with science. Question: what is eating pepper X like? In hot sauce and in salsa and candy and things, it tastes delicious. But when it is eaten raw, the flavor lasts only for a millisecond, and then the heat is just taking off. And it's not a very pleasant experience. I wouldn't recommend eating it raw to anybody, and if somebody wants me to do it again, they're going to have to pay me a lot of money. A Reaper usually takes me about half an hour to recover from, including the cramps. Pepper X took me 5 to 6 hours, but I ate more peppers for dinner that night. Question: what's the advantage of having a super hot pepper? The advantage of the super hot peppers is economy of scale. Say you're using cayenne to get a pepper sauce as hot as you want it. You might use 2 to 3 pounds of cayenne, whereas with pepper X, to get the same heat, you would need maybe just 1/8 of a gram of dried pepper. I'll give you an example. There was a manufacturer who was using 11.55 gallon drums of a pepper in a recipe. I knew one of the executives there, and I said, "Just try it with 1 15-gallon drum of Reaper." They got the same heat and saved 80% of the money they were spending. Final question: do you think you can go hotter? Oh yeah, I know we can. We've tested a lot of peppers at a higher level, but we don't yet have a lot of years of averages. You show the average of the tests when you're reporting the Scoville rating. You don't show your single highest test. I think we can achieve a lot more, but there's really not much use for it, unless it tastes good. And this Q&A with Ed Curry: how hot is pepper X? It appears in the Scientific American February 2024 issue. Next, to book reviews from the same issue of Scientific American. Reviews are edited by Amy Brady. The first, Serious and Silly Science, a collection of 71 micro-essays on subjects ranging from hangover myths to pansexual primates. The review is written by Chuck Wendig. The book that is being reviewed is called How to Win Friends and Influence Fungi, Collected Quirks of Science, Tech, Engineering, and Math from Nerd Night, edited by Chris Balakrishnan and Matt Wasowski. As an author of science fiction and horror novels, I am called on to seem like an expert on the various topics I write about. Pandemics, artificial intelligence, ants, when really I'm just trying to use true facts to suspend readers' disbelief and convince them that my made-up worlds are rooted in reality. One of the greatest tools in my toolbox, then, is nonfiction that is both salient and accessible, so that I might steal its concepts. I'm always looking for material that is relevant to the work at hand, but it isn't so demonstrative of its expertise that it sails over my head like a near-miss asteroid. Or as one essay about catastrophic cosmic collisions in this book calls them, asteroids. In How to Win Friends and Influence Fungi, I have found my new holy Bible, a scattershot blast of science-y, mathy, techie, micro-essays that span a dizzying array of subjects. The book serves as an aggregation of some of the most memorable presentations in the 20-year history of Nerd Night, a monthly event hosted across 100 cities worldwide, designed to let audiences show up, have a drink, and learn some weird, true stuff. Editors Chris Balakrishnan and Matt Wasowski, Nerd Night is their brain baby, wanted to make it possible for anyone to flip to a page and partake in a short burst of fascination. With illustrations by Kristen Orr, the book succeeds in making its diverse subject matter immediately accessible. The style is light, quirky, funny, and occasionally hilarious. The 71 essays are roughly gathered into chapters, including creature features, pathogens and parasites, death and taxes, but really just death, and a sex-themed section, doing it. Want to know why someone's eating noises make you murderous? Jane Gregory, a clinical psychologist, will inform you of a condition she herself suffers. Misophonia, or when small, repetitive sounds cause big, negative reactions. Curious about how birds have sex? Nerd Night founder Balakrishnan, who is also a biologist, writes about cloacal kisses and duck penises. Did you know you probably suffer from vasalgia from time to time, even though you don't know what that is? It's a fancy word for hangovers, and neuroscientist Paula Croxon will teach you all you need to know about it and its many, purely theoretical, mostly fake, cures. That's only a shaving of the iceberg of information contained in the collection's pages. You'll also find bits on pansexual primates, defecating in space, maggot therapy, arachnid sex catapults, the surprising awesomeness of GMOs, the surprising not-so-awesomeness of antibacterial soap, and chindogu, the Japanese art of making eccentric, largely unuseless inventions. Bits is the keyword here. Most of these essays are 2, 3, maybe 4 pages. None of them would qualify as a full meal's worth of knowledge, and sometimes the essays end abruptly, just as they get going, thus delivering a sense of info discuss interruptus that leaves you frustrated and wanting to know more, more, more. But if you approach this book as a grazing table full of scientific amuse-bouche, each a single bite of fascination, then your curiosity will be piqued instead of fully satisfied, motivating you to more deeply explore the subjects that especially catch your attention. As a person who occasionally has the sense of humor of a 12-year-old, I dig the pop culture references and the abundant puns, and count me in for all the lurid, silly jokes about sex stuff and our variously bodily excretions, puerile as they sometimes are. That said, it's not all about the chuckles. You'll find sharp, measured takes on disability, sexuality, mental illness, the open internet, and further, the book does good work in attempting to combat misinformation and disinformation in the spaces of science and technology. For instance, in an essay on the public panic over genetically modified organisms, they're putting acid in our food, exclamation point. Tracy Kurtz, a Nerd Night organizer in Fargo, North Dakota, reminds us that we've been genetically modifying our food for thousands of years. If the book has one weakness, it's that the essays are unequal in quality. Many are written well, successfully connecting readers to the implications of the science and making jokes that earn their chuckles. But several feel too shallow and don't deliver entirely on either knowledge or laughs. These ups and downs are perhaps to be expected, given the sheer breadth of subject matter and the fact that each micro-essay is penned by a different author. Ultimately, the fun here is the joy of discovery, in coming away effervescent with renewed curiosity for the universe in which we live. And the writer of this review, Chuck Wendig, is the New York Times best-selling author of Wanderers, The Book of Accidents, and more. His review of the nonfiction book, How to Win Friends and Influence Fungi, Collected Quirks of Science, Tech, Engineering, and Math from Nerd Night, appears in the February 2024 issue of Scientific American. And so does a review of a book, Countdown: The Blinding Future of Nuclear Weapons, written by Sarah Scholes. The review, by Omar El-Akkad, is entitled Nuclear Mysteries: An Exploration of the Uncertainties Inside America's Atomic Arsenal Update. The central premise of Sarah Scholes' fascinating new book is at once straightforward and disconcerting. The U.S. is in the middle of a massive refurbishment campaign to upgrade its geriatric nuclear arsenal. And yet nobody, not even the people charged with that task, knows precisely how these weapons operate. The inner workings of the most destructive thing human beings have ever built remain, in large part, a mystery. From that starting point, Scholes, who is a contributor to Scientific American, ventures on a kaleidoscope interrogation of the weird, secretive fraternity that is America's nuclear sector. Traditionally, it's not a particularly well-explored space, despite our recent Oppenheimer-fueled obsession with all things atomic. The reality of modern nuclear weapons work is at once much less spectacular and much more intricate than one might imagine. An entire alphabet of acronymic agencies responsible for everything from cleaning up radioactive spills to conducting CSI-style investigations of hypothetical dirty bomb detonations. At its most interesting, Countdown is an exploration of uncertainty in a field whose awesome destructive capacity makes uncertainty a deeply worrying thing. Because of bans on above-ground nuclear testing, the traditional method of figuring out how nuclear bombs work, namely blowing them up, isn't feasible anymore. So scientists are left with computer models and other esoteric techniques to try to figure out, for example, how the radioactive matter in nuclear bombs changes over many decades in storage. The weakest part of the book is, unfortunately, outside of Scholes' control. Few facets of government work are as heavily classified as the nuclear program, and as a result, many anecdotes and narrative threads come to a hard stop, not at any satisfying conclusion, but rather when the documentary trail becomes inaccessible or when an interview subject turns reticent. Nevertheless, Scholes does get at the heart of the many paradoxes that frame the nuclear age. The people she speaks to, some of them inspired to do this work because they believe that nuclear weapons are a means of deterrence, a means of making the world safer, are clearly engaged in their own internal struggles with self-doubt. In this way, a book chronicling the stewards of our deadliest weapons of war becomes, at times, the story of people at quiet war with themselves. And this review of the book Countdown was written by Omar El-Akkad. Entitled Nuclear Mysteries, An Exploration of the Uncertainties Inside America's Atomic Arsenal Update. And book reviews in brief. Twice Lived by Joma West, the review written by Alan Scherstuhl. Joma West's urgent slice-of-life novel imagines a reality where, from the womb and into adolescence, some children switch at unpredictable intervals, vanishing into a parallel world, leaving behind their selves, names, and families, until they switch back. At some point, they settle into a single existence. This moving book explores how different upbringings can yield different selves, centering on one teen, Kanna in one life and Lily in the other, and her mother in each place, both of whom fear the next switch might mean Kanna/Lily never returns. As each iteration of the protagonist strives to stay in the world she loves, West's brisk, chatty scenecraft proves as resonant emotionally as the premise is conceptually. A Fire So Wild, a novel. Written by Sarah Ruiz Grossman, published by Harper 2024, the review is written by Lorraine Savage. Sarah Ruiz Grossman presents a passionate yet critical observation of the devastating effects of a California wildfire that indiscriminately upends the lives of residents from various socioeconomic backgrounds. Wealthy Abigail organizes fundraisers for low-income housing, but now finds her own house reduced to ashes. Sunny, a homeless construction worker, was promised one of the new apartments, but the fire puts that on hold. Middle-income high school teacher Gabriel and his ex-wife search for their teenage daughter, who was with Abigail's son during the blaze. Ruiz Grossman's piercing commentary reveals the inequality and injustices of climate change for people just trying to live their lives. And finally, Birding to Change the World, a memoir written by Trish O'Kane, published by Echo in 2024, the review written by Dana Dunham. Struggling to cope with the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, Trish O'Kane becomes an accidental birder when her connection with a single cardinal opens her eyes to the hope and healing of birdwatching. As a PhD student and passionate amateur ornithologist in Wisconsin, O'Kane attempts to defend the local bird populations against constant threats by emulating the birds themselves. A starling murmuration, a chevron of geese, a squawking flock of mobbing crows represent avian attributes, talents, and skills our species urgently needs. Fascinating revelations, even about the humble sparrow, punctuate this thoughtful discussion of complex birding issues, such as wildlife management and environmental justice. These five reviews, Serious and Silly Science, Nuclear Mysteries, a review of Twice Lived, A Fire So Wild, a novel, and Birding to Change the World, a memoir, all appear in the February 2024 issue of Scientific American. And now we turn to New York Times trilobites. First, fossils show giant predatory sea scorpions were distance swimmers. Specimens of what appear to be the largest Eurypterid species found in Australia could shed light on the sudden extinction of the massive arthropods. Posted on August 16, 2024, and written by Rebecca Zombach. Most modern scorpions would fit in the palm of your hand, but in the oceans of the Paleozoic era, more than 400 million years ago, animals known popularly as sea scorpions were apex predators that could grow larger than people in size. They were effectively functioning as sharks, said Russell Bicknell, a paleobiologist at the American Museum of Natural History. New research by Dr. Bicknell and colleagues, published a few weeks ago in the journal Gondwana Research and relying on Australian fossils, reveals that the biggest sea scorpions were capable of crossing oceans, a finding that is absolutely pushing the limits of what we know arthropods could do, he said. What are commonly known as sea scorpions were a diverse group of arthropods called Eurypterids. They came in many shapes and sizes, but are perhaps best known for their largest representatives, which could grow to more than 9 feet long. With huge claws, a beefy exoskeleton, and a strong set of legs for swimming, the larger sea scorpions most likely ruled the seas. However fearsome these arthropods must have been to Paleozoic prey, they went extinct without much of a bang. The fossil record of Eurypterids peaked in the Silurian period, which started about 444 million years ago, and they then abruptly died out after the early Devonian period ended about 393 million years ago. That sudden turn of fate has left scientists bewildered. They start doing really well, they get very big, and then they go extinct, said James Lamsdell, a paleobiologist at West Virginia University, who was not involved in the study. For a while, they were so dominant, and then they just burned out. Giant arthropods haven't been seen since, and better understanding how widespread gigantic sea scorpions were could lay the groundwork to explain why that is. Most Eurypterid fossils have come from North America and Europe, with a few unearthed more recently in China. While some Eurypterid fossils had been previously reported in Australia, they were fragments too broken up and ambiguous to identify whether they were the biggest sea scorpion species. Dr. Bicknell's study documents a new set of Eurypterid fossils from Australia. They're fragments too, but he suspected they could be identified. Careful examination revealed that the fragments were mostly exoskeleton, including a potential headpiece with suggestions of an eye. Dr. Bicknell was confident enough in the pieces that he assigned them two kinds of Eurypterid, Pterygotus and the biggest known sea scorpion, Jaecolopterus. Dr. Bicknell's analysis of the rock formations in which the fossils were found showed that they were essentially identical to those where the fossils had been found on the other side of the world, shallow seas and deltas around the shores of continents. One set of fossils was found with armored fish, and another with a bit of fossil droppings containing trilobite fragments, suggesting the sea scorpions could have been chowing down on crunchy prey. The fragments are better than what had previously been found, although uncovering more specimens in Australia would help solidify the case, Dr. Lamstill said. If Dr. Bicknell is correct, the fossils expand the biggest sea scorpions' range to the ancient supercontinent Gondwana, where they had not been found before. The finding also supports sea scorpions' ability to cross oceans, which was no small feat. At the time, a journey between Gondwana and the supercontinent Euramerica could have been thousands of miles depending on the route. It's really cool to see that. Yeah, they were traveling really far, Dr. Bicknell said. They actually made it to Gondwana. Dr. Bicknell hopes further study will reveal whether giant sea scorpions arrived in a one-time migration event or if they moved seasonally. That huge sea scorpions made this journey hints that gigantism could have played an important role in migration. It could have simply been that animals needed a big body to survive in the oceans, like ocean-going sharks and whales today, Dr. Lamstill said. Once they got big enough, they could make the trek. But why sea scorpions' large size would enable such global success and still allow them to go extinct a geologically short while later remains a mystery. Having a better handle on their range will point scientists to new places to hunt for fossils, which in turn could help clear things up. Over time, there'll be more discoveries, Dr. Lamstill said. Then we'll get an even better idea of what's going on with these animals. And this trilobite, fossils show giant predatory sea scorpions were distance swimmers, was posted on August 16, 2024. Our second New York Times trilobite explores another marine animal, but this time a mammal. Entitled I Am the Walrus, But This Fossil Was Not, was published on August 13th and updated on August 14th, 2024. Written by Asher Elbine. Although an extinct animal was from a different group of marine mammals, an examination of fossils showed it evolved a way of eating that was very similar to that of modern walruses. Some 2 million years ago, a large mammal swimming through the North Atlantic Ocean hauled its bulk up onto a beach, its belly full of clams. It had blubber, tusks, and more than likely, whiskers. Sounds like a walrus, right? In fact, the extinct animal was a member of a different marine mammal genus entirely, as different from a modern walrus as a fox is from your dog. For all the evolutionary differences between the animals, researchers say in a study published last week in the journal PeerJ Life and Environment, this relative of the walrus may have used a very similar foraging strategy, suction feeding. Mathieu Boisville, a paleontologist at the University of Tsukuba in Japan and an author of the study, said that it's really something quite rare in the field of fossil marine mammals for two large animals to develop such similar adaptations, a phenomenon known as convergent evolution. The false walrus, which Dr. Boisville and his colleagues named Ontocetus posti, belongs to a group of marine animals that first appeared around 5 million years ago on the Pacific coast of North America, before spreading into the Atlantic Ocean via the not-yet-closed seaway between North and South America. Most remains from animals in the group are found around the southeastern shores of the United States, but over several decades, amateurs and paleontologists found scraps of skull and a lower jaw along the coasts and seabed of the North Sea, Dr. Boisville said, not far from regions around the towns of Antwerp in Belgium and Norwich in England. For a long time, the remains were classified as a separate species. When Dr. Boisville's team studied the fossils, however, they noticed that the jaws were more walrus-like than those of their southern relatives. Like its close kin, Ontocetus posti had a complement of teeth, including lower incisors and a large lower canine, but its heavy chin bones were fused, like those of a modern walrus. The anatomical similarities are notable because of the particular way that modern walruses get their prey, rustling up shelled mollusks from the mud with their lips, using their tongue like a piston to pull out the flesh, and slurping it down. The specific anatomy of walrus jaws, an arch at the top of their mouths, and fused bones help them manage the physical strain that the suction places on the skull, Dr. Boisville said. While the southern species wasn't an effective suction feeder, Ontocetus posti appeared to have evolved to favor the technique. Not everyone is sure that this walrus's jaws represent a case of convergent evolution, however. The combination of traits seen in modern walruses and an earlier species might be a sign of a direct evolutionary transition between the two, said Robert Bussenecker, a marine mammal paleontologist who was not involved in the study. And while the new study proposes that Ontocetus posti preferred warmer waters than modern walruses do, this might be a fluke of the fossil record. Wild changes in sea levels around 2.6 million years ago left few viable fossil sites from the period in the North Atlantic, and that has rendered marine mammal evolution at the time a black box, Dr. Bussenecker said. In other words, Ontocetus could have lived in the Arctic Circle, and we'd never know from the fossil record. The same instability in sea levels that distorted the fossil record wrought havoc on marine ecosystems, leading to shakeups among whales and pinnipeds, and the disappearance of creatures like the marine sloth, the ultimate birds of Japan, and the fearsome giant shark. Between growing glaciers, expanding Arctic ice caps, and changes in the diversity of mollusks, the North Sea also became an inhospitable place to live. By 1 million years ago, Ontocetus posti had disappeared. Hundreds of thousands of years before modern walruses arrived in the North Atlantic and swam smoothly into the same niche. The beautiful thing about walruses is that they can tell us about climate change, Dr. Boisville said. It's also amazing to observe that in the past, animals evolved to try and survive in the face of past climate change, in this case, rapid global climate cooling. Only those species that were better able to adapt to these rapid climatic changes had any chance of surviving, he added. And this New York Times trilobite, I am the walrus, but this fossil was not, was posted on August 14, 2024. And now for our third and final trilobite in this program, how the world's oldest humpback whale has survived is a mystery. Old Timer, a male first photographed in 1972, was spotted last month near Alaska, enduring in the Pacific Ocean while some other humpbacks have struggled in a changing environment. By Emily Anthes, posted on August 14, 2024. A humpback whale's tail is as unique as a fingerprint. The lobes, or flukes, at the end of the tail have scalloped edges that vary from whale to whale. The undersides feature distinct black and white patterns that mark a whale for life. When Adam A. Pack, a marine mammal researcher at the University of Hawaii at Hilo, was photographing whales in Alaska's Frederick Sound in July, he instantly recognized the flukes, a of an old friend. Emphasis on old. The tail, mostly black, with a wash of white speckles near the edge, belongs to a whale named Old Timer. First spotted in 1972, Old Timer is now a male of at least 53 years, making him the oldest known humpback whale in the world, said Dr. Pack, who is also the co-founder and president of the Dolphin Institute. Humpback whale populations, once severely depleted by commercial whaling, have rebounded in recent decades. But the animals are threatened by ship strikes, entanglements in fishing gear, and climate change. And Dr. Pack had worried about Old Timer. The last time he had seen the whale in 2015 was in the middle of a record-breaking year-long heat wave. Scores of seabirds and marine mammals, including humpback whales, died. But after 9 years, he saw with his own eyes that Old Timer had survived. It was heartwarming because I realized it wasn't just the old whales who were perishing, Dr. Pack said. Some of them were resilient. Historically, tracking the whereabouts of the whales had been done the hard way, by scientists using their own eyes to compare new fluke photos with old ones. But future studies of Old Timer and other humpbacks of all ages are set to be accelerated with artificial intelligence. And Dr. Pack hopes it will help him learn how and why some whales can withstand tough conditions. Multiple humpback populations dwell in the North Pacific. Old Timer is part of a population that spends winters breeding in the waters around Hawaii and summers in southeastern Alaska, filling up on fish and tiny shrimp-like animals known as krill. These humpbacks have been the subject of an ongoing scientific study, which began in 1976, when a marine mammal researcher, Lewis Herman, began photographing the whales and their distinctive flukes. Dr. Herman conducted annual surveys, amassing an enormous collection of tail pictures that allowed scientists to keep tabs on individual whales over the course of their lifetimes. These fluke photos, which now number more than 30,000, have provided new insight into the lives of whales, from their migration patterns to their social behaviors. It's one of the longest ongoing scientific studies of humpback whales in the world, said Dr. Pack, one of Dr. Herman's former students and colleagues, and now leader of the Whale Project. The study is now entering the age of machine learning with the help of an online platform called Happy Whale, which collects whale fluke photos from scientists and members of the public from around the world. The Happy Whale database currently contains roughly 1.1 million images of more than 100,000 individual humpbacks, said Ted Cheesman, a co-founder of Happy Whale and a PhD candidate at Southern Cross University in Australia. Artificial intelligence-powered photo matching algorithms help automatically identify the whales in submitted photos, aiding scientists in the field or others who need to look up previous sightings of a given animal. Happy Whale has revolutionized our field and has made large-scale collaborations possible, Dr. Pack said. Earlier this year, Dr. Cheesman, Dr. Pack, and dozens of other researchers used Happy Whale's image recognition tool to estimate humpback whale abundance in the North Pacific from 2002 through 2021. Initially, the population boomed, climbing to about 33,500 whales in 2012. But then it dropped sharply. This population decline coincided with a severe marine heat wave when Dr. Pack last spotted Old Timer. It lasted from 2014 to 2016 and slashed the supply of fish and krill. There's a lot more we want to learn about the event, but it is quite clear. Warmer waters mean food is less available overall, and what is available is more dispersed and deeper, Dr. Cheesman said in an email. The Hawaii humpback population was especially hard hit, falling by 34% from 2013 to 2021. Although there had been some sightings of Old Timer reported after 2015, Dr. Pack was excited to finally set eyes on the whale himself. That excitement soon gave way to curiosity. Why had Old Timer survived when so many others had perished? Now, Dr. Pack is hoping to dive deeper himself with the help of Happy Whale. He plans to investigate how humpbacks survived the lean years and whether there are any discernible patterns. Could Old Timer's age have been an advantage? It is possible that Old Timer's been around enough to be adaptable, when certain food resources are limited, Dr. Pack said. The idea remains speculative, and it is not yet clear whether Old Timer was the exception or the rule. How many whales like Old Timer were resilient to this devastation of marine resources, he said. And this New York Times trilobite was written by Emily Anthes, who is a science reporter writing primarily about animal health and science. She also covered the coronavirus pandemic. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week. Happy holidays.